Related to the absolute truth.
Related to the absolute truth.
Purvesham.
Purvesham.
Of our predecessors.
Of our predecessors.
Such as Narada.
Such as Narada.
Purvagyahai.
Purvagyahai.
By the predecessors.
By the predecessors.
Such as Sonaka.
Such as Sonaka.
Dhrita.
Dhrita.
Meditated upon.
Meditated upon.
Shraddhaya.
Shraddhaya.
With faith.
With faith.
Dharayat.
Dharayat.
Meditates.
Meditates.
Yaha.
Yaha.
Whoever.
Whoever.
Tam.
Tam.
Upon it.
Upon it.
Shemam.
Shemam.
Ultimate success.
Ultimate success.
Gachet.
Gachet.
Will attain.
Will attain.
Akinchanaha.
Akinchanaha.
Free from material connection.
Free from material connection.
So translation. Those who came before even our ancient predecessors meditated upon the same confidential knowledge of the absolute truth. Indeed, anyone who faithfully concentrates on this knowledge will become free from material attachments and attain the final goal of life. To repeat, those who came before,
those who came before,
even our ancient predecessors,
even our ancient predecessors,
meditated upon the same,
meditated upon the same,
confidential knowledge of the absolute truth,
confidential knowledge of the absolute truth.
Indeed, anyone who faithfully concentrates,
indeed, anyone who faithfully concentrates
on this knowledge,
on this knowledge,
will become free from material attachments,
will become free from material attachments,
and attain the final goal of life,
and attain the final goal of life.
So, purport, this confidential knowledge concerning the absolute truth should not be doubted, since it has been passed down through authoritative lines of learned sages from time immemorial. One who cultivates the science of the Supreme with reverence, avoiding the distractions of fruitive rituals and mental speculation, will learn to give up the false designations of material body and mundane society. And thus he will become eligible for perfection. In the opinion of Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti, the first two verses of this chapter can be considered an Upanishad on the topic of Brahman. Shukadeva Goswami here disclaims authorship on the grounds that this Upanishad was spoken previously by Narada Muni, who himself heard it from Sanaka Kumara. Saisha Upanishad Brahmi Purvesham Purvajaya Dhrita Shraddhaya Dharaya Yastam Shemam Gacchet Akinchanaha. So, Om Maganatim Dandasha Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Om Militam Yenat Tosmai Shivarave Maha. So, does anyone know what the word Upanishad means? Any Sanskrit experts?
In Sri Yusha Upanishad, Srila Prabhupada defines it that knowledge which brings one closer to God.
Yes. It means to come closer. And actually, it's described by many of the Vedic scholars to come closer to the spiritual master. To approach the spiritual master, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Tadvini, Pramipatena Paribrasmena Sevya. That if you want to learn the truth, you have to approach the bona fide spiritual master, inquire some wisdom, and render service, etc. You all know that verse. So, in order to understand the Upanishads, one has to approach a guru. Tasmad guru prapadyeta hiyasa shaya uttama. If you want to understand hiyasa shaya, transcendental knowledge, it is essential to approach, right, the spiritual master. So that's really the Upanishads. In order to understand the Upanishads, you have to have a guru. I mean, there's so many stories within the Upanishads that illustrate that point. And then, There's a commentary on the Upanishads. Does anyone know what the commentary on the Upanishads is? Any other sages here? The Vedanta Sutra. The Brahma Sutra, Vedanta Sutra. They're a commentary on the Upanishads. And the specific verses, of course, the Brahma Sutra is written in codes, not Morse code, of course. But codes meaning sutra, means like a thread, basically, or a very short statement. That making that short statement, there is an assumption that the person knows how to fill in the details, you know, like a tato brahma jigyasa, or that now is the time to search for the absolute truth. Like, if you don't know the details, don't have a spiritual master, you won't know how to do it. I say, well, now is the time to search for the absolute truth. Where am I going to look, you know, in the French Quarter? So you have to know the proper procedure. And then also, jama jasha yataha ambaya, etc., like the Bhagavatam begins with. Isn't it? And the absolute truth is that from which everything comes. So there is a direct correspondence between most of the verses in the Vedanta Sutra and specific Upanishads. You can relate the verses. I mean, the scholars have done that. And it's, you know, it's a fact. And then we have a commentary. We have commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra. What are the commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra?
Srimad Bhagavatam,
which is our commentary. Also, we have other commentaries in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. There's one other commentary. Does anyone know what the other commentary is?
The Govinda Bhash,
written by Baladev Vidyabhushan, under the direction of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And, of course, then in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, they have the Srivas. So all these Sampradayas, they have a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Without a commentary in the Vedanta Sutra, the Sampradaya is not accepted. And that was actually the argument given by the Ramanandis to Baladev Vidyabhushana when he went to Jaipur. I think most of you know that story. That the Ramanandis, they had separated Radha and Govinda. You know, the Radha Govinda deities were originally installed by Rupa Goswami in Vrindavan at the Radha Govinda temple. And they were taken to Jaipur because of the threat of the Muslims. The Muslims were destroying temples, trying to smash deities. And actually, practically speaking, one of the only deities that they weren't able to remove from Vrindavan was the Vrindadevi deity. And some of you may know about this, that there's on the western side of Braj, there's this place called Kamyavan. Anyone's been to Kamyavan here? You've been there. So they tried to take her out, she wouldn't move. That's the original Vrindadevi deity. It's in Kamyavan. And so they just couldn't get her out because she wouldn't leave Vrindavan. Very interesting story. And in any case, let's go back to Radha Govinda. So Radha Govinda, they were in Jaipur and being worshipped, and the Ramanandis, they convinced the king to separate Radharani and Govinda. And they said, you know, where is it in the Vedic literature is that Radharani is being worshipped along with Krishna? Of course, this is very esoteric knowledge, the knowledge of Radha and Krishna. In fact, even in Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadev Goswami doesn't directly state Radharani's name, but he says, she who is worshipping, and using the name within Anuradhika, within the word of worship, because Radharani means, Radha means to worship. So they had some disturbance like that, and then the Gaudiya Vaishnavas got upset. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, they sent a message to him, and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was too, old to make the trip from Braj to Jaipur, so he sent Baladev Vidyabhushana, and then Baladev Vidyabhushana went there, and they challenged him. He was able to defeat them. And then they challenged him, well, where's your commentary on the Vedanta Sutra? And he said, Srimad Bhagavatam is the mature commentary. But they didn't accept that. They said, there has to be a Gaudiya commentary on the Vedanta, because it's Gaudiya Vaishnavism. You know, we're in the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. that means Lord Brahma, and then Madhvacharya, and down through the Lord Chaitanya and his associates. Like that, so there has to be a commentary in that specific branch of the Sampradaya. And so he didn't know what to do, so he prayed to Lord Govinda. Govinda dictated this Govinda Bhashan. Within about 2 or 3 days, he wrote the whole commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. And when he presented it, practically speaking, they fainted. They couldn't believe it. And then they all surrendered to him. And Radha and Govinda were rejoined. There's an actual esoteric explanation for the reason why Radha and Govinda were separated. They had an argument. And the acharyas explained that, you know, the deities wouldn't be separated unless they desired it. So there was an argument between Radha and Krishna. And there was some separation and coming back together. Just like sometimes you see in the pastimes written by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur and other acharyas and even Kavi Kanarpur. They write about how Krishna does things to make Radharani angry and she just like walks away. And Krishna wants to do that. There's one story that I was just reading where Krishna was, so this is a Gauri Kund story. Yeah, Krishna was with Radharani, and then he, as we mentioned yesterday, he by accident on purpose said the name of Chandravali, and that aggravated her. And then he asked Brinda to also aggravate Radharani more by having one of her monkeys say something about him being with Chandravali. So Radharani just like left. And then Krishna had his whole plan. He said, oh, again to associate with Srimati Radharani, I will put on the guise or the dress of a woman. So he asked Brinda for some ladies' garments, so he put on some ladies' garments. And also he took the jewels from the deity at Gauri Kund, which is right near Govardhan, right inside of Govardhan, frankly speaking. And he put these jewels on, and then he was able to meet with Radharani at the Gauri temple. Gauri is, of course, the goddess Durga. So he was meeting with her at the temple, and then along comes... of course, he was in the guise of a woman. So along comes Jatila. Mm. Does anyone know who Jatila is?
His mother-in-law.
So even in the Vedic literatures, we have mother-in-law stories. Mm. It's not something modern. You know, when I was young, they would always make these mother-in-law jokes. But actually, it's even bona fide. So what happened is that along comes Jatila. She listens in the door of the Gauri temple, and she hears something's going on between Radha and Krishna. And she goes back and gets her son, Abhimanyu. And they both think, now we're going to catch Radha and Krishna in the act. Mm-hmm. And they think, we got them this time. Because they're always trying to catch them, and they're never able to. Krishna's extremely tricky. Mm-hmm. And the original romance... story, romance, drama. And Rupa Goswami, this story is actually from Rupa Goswami, that's in the Vidagda Madhava. Sorry, that's the last chapter of the Vidagda Madhava. So, what happens is that Abhimanyu and Jatila, they come back and they sort of break into the room. Hmm. But Krishna's still dressed as a woman. Hmm. And so they break into the room, and Radharani, when she sees them coming in, she faints. But she faints at the feet of Krishna, who is dressed as a woman, whom they think is Gauri, the goddess Durga. So they actually walk in, and they think that actually it's not Krishna. Radharani is just offering obeisances to Durga, who's come out of the deity. You understand? That Durga has actually come out of the deity to accept Radharani's worship. Mm-hmm. And there is Radharani, the pain Dandabad's feel by accident because she fainted at Durga's feet. Interesting story. Mm-hmm. And so, they think that, wow, she's actually a great devotee. And then, at that time, Durga begins to speak. Mm-hmm. And because previously, Previously, Abhimanyu had plans to send Radharani out of Vrindavan because he was suspicious. I mean, he had reason to be suspicious. And he wanted to protect her from Krishna. Imagine wanting to protect Radharani from Krishna. It's interesting dynamic. So the deity began to speak, and the deity said, the deity was actually Krishna, of course, dressed up, as they say now, in drag. You understand that statement?
No, what's that mean?
Drag means when a man dresses up as a woman. I'm sure you've seen that in French quarter. So everything's there in the spiritual world. You know, there's romance sneaking around, you know, Krishna dressing up as a woman, and, you know, there's even stories of Radharani dressing up as a man. Sometimes she dresses up as Subal, so she can sneak out of her house to be with Krishna. So even about cross-dressing in the spiritual world. So there's nothing new. In other words, everything we have here is a reflection of what's happening in the spiritual world. But it's all there in this pristine, pure state full of eternity, bliss, and knowledge. Where here it's full of ignorance, misery, temporary nature. You know, it's just like, it's nasty. So if you want to overcome your desire to hear or to participate in these mundane affairs, you hear about Krishna doing these things. That's a disease. Balosho Shotra Munobiramat. That is Chukadeva Goswami's statement at the beginning of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam 10.1.4. He says that Nirittatar Shara Upagiyamanat Balosho Shotra Munobiramat Kavutama Shlava Vananabharat Puman Virajeta Vananapashudnat. Very interesting verse. That's a, actually it's one of the like little nutshell verses of the 10th canto. He says, extremely important, Prabhupada would quote this verse too. Nivritta Tarsha, we're actually suffering from miseries within this material world because we're trying to enjoy, and it's not enjoyable. Nivritta Tarsha Upigimana, you can overcome these miseries, you know, these Tarsha miseries. Bhavoshana Shotra Manobirama. If you actually hear and chant about Krishna's pastimes, Krishna is described ka uttama shloka, that means transcendental verses. Gunanavada, his qualities are described, everything is described in the transcendental literatures. And the only people, this is, the last line is quite interesting because I use that quite often, is Puman Virajeta Vanapashudna. The only people who are not going to be able to appreciate this are killers of animals. Pashu. Pashu means animal. Sometimes it's taken as killers of the soul, but the literal translation is Pashuvnat means to those who, the now Pashuvnat, except for those who are killers of the animals. You know, meat eaters, killers of the animals, transporting the meat, whatever it is, or serving, cooking. Those people will not be able to understand transcendental or be attracted to Krishna's transcendental pastimes. So anyway, so this is the remedial measure. That's what this verse describes. The remedial measure for overcoming the miseries of material existence to hear and chant about Krishna's pastime. So anyway, let's get back to the pastime that was described. So Krishna, as Durga says out loud, Abhimanyu, you're going to die because Kamsa is going to come and cut your head off. So Abhimanyu and Jatila necessarily get a little nervous about the whole thing because Durga, you know, everybody believes Durga, right? And Durga's saying that you're going to die. And then Jatila gets down and begs Gauri Mata, who was actually Krishna. No, no, no. What did he ever do? And Gauri, who is Krishna, says he actually didn't trust Radharani. He was the most chaste person and he wants to send her out of Vrindavan. And they say, forgive him, forgive him. And Durga says, never. I will never, he will never be forgiven. There's no question about it. So then Radharani comes back to external consciousness at that time. Because remember, she's fainted seeing her so-called husband there. So she comes back to external consciousness and she says, she understands the trick that Krishna's playing. And she gets in on the whole trick. And she says, But please save my husband, save my husband. Please, please. My husband, he must be saved. I love him so much. You know, it's a big act. And finally, Durga, who is Krishna, says, because you are praying, I will protect and save your husband. But only if he vows never to distrust you again, never to think that you're going around with Krishna. Remember, Krishna is saying this. Never to think that you're going around with Krishna, never to try to send you out of Vrindavan. If only if he agrees that, then he will be saved. And then Jatila and Abhimanyu, they say, all right, we agree, we trust her. We'll never distrust her again. And then Durga said, Durga, who is Krishna, says, all right, he will be saved. And so they breathe a sigh of relief, and they said, let's let Radharani worship Durga here alone. And yes. They leave. It was a really interesting story. Anyway, so getting back to the whole point, so that's Radha Govinda. The reason I told that story is because why were Radha and Govinda separated? Because in that story, wow, ecstasy, symptoms of ecstasy. So in that story, you find like an argument between Radha and Govinda, so also with the Radha Govinda deities, they were separated. And therefore, the Govinda Vash, or the commentary in the Vedanta Sutra written by the Gaudiyas, was accomplished by Baladeva Vibhushana. So, anyway, so we have the commentary on the Vedanta Sutras, we have the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the mature commentary of the Vedanta Sutras, and then we have Srila Prabhupada's commentaries or purports on the Srimad Bhagavatam. And Prabhupada said these purports are his devotional ecstasies. They're actually an integral part of the Srimad Bhagavatam. What do I mean by integral part? Because the Srimad Bhagavatam is a dynamic literature. It expands. Like the original Srimad Bhagavatam was how many verses? Anyone know?
Four, right?
Four verses. There were four verses. That's the Bhagavatam spoken by Lord Vishnu, spoken to Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma meditated for, you know, 1,000 celestial years, or 100 celestial years, I forget the number. It was a long time. And then, because he heard the instructions from his guru, Krishna were what? There was actually just one word.
Tapa.
You know, just the foremost areas. And he had so much faith. I wish we had faith in the instructions. If we had faith, everything would be revealed to us too. Yasha Devi Parabhaktiya. Isn't it? If you have faith in the words of the spiritual master in the Vedic literatures, everything is revealed to you. So that was the point. He had faith and he followed. And Krishna says, for the doubting soul, there's happiness neither in this world nor in the next. So he had faith, he followed, and then after some time, Krishna revealed to him all the truths. You know, he composed the Brahma Samhita. And he heard the Srimad Bhagavatam. In other words, the four nutshell verses before the creation, there was I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. During the creation, there's I. And after the creation, there's I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then, that verse, how to search for the Absolute Truth. Then the Achinchabeda Beda Tatva philosophy was taught to Lord Brahma. Really interesting. I'm not going to go over the whole four nutshell verses. So in any case, and then Lord Brahma spoke that to Narada. And then Narada Muni, as described here in this verse, as spoken previously by Narada Muni. So Narada Muni expanded on that. And he spoke it to his disciple, Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva spoke to Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva spoke to Parikshit Maharaj, but also within that assembly was Asuta Goswami. Actually, Asuta Goswami was present with his father, Ramaharshana Sutta, but Ramaharshana Sutta had an unfortunate demise. You know that story? He got killed by Balaram because he didn't offer obeisances to Balaram. So, and then Asuta Goswami spoke to Shankarishi and the sages at Naimisharanya when they're performing that 100-year sacrifice. And so the point I'm making is that Srimad Bhagavatam gets dynamically expanded like that by the pure devotees. It is a manifestation, it is the book Bhagavat manifestation of person Bhagavat and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It protects religious principles, Krishna Swadhamu Bhakate, Dhamagyana Visaha, Kalamesta, Drishamesha, Purnamako Dhanogata. It protects religion in this age of Kali. And so Prabhupada's purports form an integral part. Now, the reason I'm talking about that is in reference to what's mentioned in this verse is this knowledge is, practically speaking, timeless, it says in the verse. There, those who came before, even our ancient predecessors, meditated upon the same confidential knowledge. So this is knowledge that, well, it's internal knowledge, but it's also been extant, and in other words, present within this world since the beginning of creation, which goes against what the anthropologists, archaeologists, linguists say, too. So I'm going to explain how they arrive and why they arrive at their faulty conclusions. You know, they say that, you know, life began, pretty much human life began, you know, 100,000 years ago, modern humans, before that there was, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Australopithecus or something like that. You know, some Aborigine people running around, and, you know, there's the missing link, which they haven't discovered quite yet. And they say, you know, this is not true. That, you know, there hasn't been spiritual knowledge for so long, and they have different methods by which they think they're examining the historicity of the Vedic literatures. But their whole motivation for examining the historicity of the Vedic literatures is the history. Yeah, history of the Vedic literatures. Historicity, that means the study of the histories. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Vedic literatures is based on a bias that they have. Mm-hmm. That bias, it's interesting how that bias arose. That originally, the first Westerners who came across the Vedic literatures, Sir Henry James or something like that, if I remember correctly, they came to the conclusion, they read them, and they came to the conclusion these Vedic literatures, or in Sanskrit itself, is far more sophisticated than Greek or Latin. So how could this be? That you have a language and literature is more sophisticated than Greek or Latin, because their philosophy is that our civilization, the Western civilization, is the pinnacle of evolution. Mm. You understand? And that started in Greece, and Rome, and all those other countries. And these are the classical languages. They call these the classical languages. You understand? You know, when I was in school, I studied Latin. I don't know, did anyone here ever study Latin?
Yeah, well, would you hear Latin in the Catholic Church?
Yeah, in the Catholic Church, but I was tested and I learned a little bit of Latin. It's an interesting language. I mean, a lot of, and it's beautiful. The Mass in Latin, which I've listened to as part of learning Latin, is very beautiful. It's a very beautiful language. Anyway, so they were astounded that here was a language more sophisticated than Greek or Latin. And they were just like, how is this possible? Because, you know, we in the West, you know, we're the advanced civilization, and these guys, how can there be any other advanced civilization? So then they postulated the only reason there's this sophisticated language is that originally some of us guys and girls invaded, that's the Aryan invasion theory, invaded India, and, you know, we sort of mixed with them, we made a mistake, we intermarried a little bit. And so we're the Aryans. You know, that's called Aryan invasion. And so it's actually, Sanskrit, they said, is a derivation of Greek or Latin or whatever, or Western languages. It's a dialect. You know, this is their... Anyway, this is the stupidity they came up with. And they said, actually, we invaded, and so we're actually the Aryans. Interesting, isn't it? Mm. And so that was based on, you know, cultural bias, and later on, of course, the religious bias came to play too. You know, the Christians are the best, and, you know, we've come to save the world, and we have to save the poor natives in India. Actually, what did Rudyard Kipling, the white man's burden, that's what he called it. He called the white man's burden. So they took it upon themselves to denigrate the Vedic literatures and the source of the Vedic literatures, and they hired many Indologists. I'm not going to mention their names because it's not pious to mention their names. They hired many Indologists, especially the British, especially hired German Indologists, Max Müller, for example. I didn't mention the name, sorry. They hired German Indologists because the Germans were more intelligent than the British. The British prophet said they're a mercantile nation. But prophet also commented on Germany, said it sounds like barking dogs. But obviously, anyone nowadays who studies Sanskrit at the university have to learn German when they're studying Sanskrit.
Really?
Yeah. You have to learn German because many of the original analyses of Sanskrit literature are written in German. Hmm. So anyway, so Max Müller was there, and then he sort of postulated the history of the Vedic literatures, you know, saying certain dates. Later on, of course, he admitted that it was just speculation, you know, he didn't really know anything. Although his speculation was later accepted by the modern day Indologists. And even today, you know, they haven't changed the textbooks. Even though the Aryan invasion theory has been really soundly defeated, even in the academic field, they haven't changed the textbooks to agree with that.
I thought that they claimed that it's from the science of language. That
no, that's called Glatto analogy. They have this thing. Yeah, that's another point. I didn't want to get into those details. They say that they can analyze the age of the Vedic literatures by this science, Glatto analogy or something like that, which is based upon how a language changes. You know, it's based upon, if you can say, take language 5,000 years ago, let's say ancient language and today's language, you can tell how old language is by how much it's different from the original language. You understand? Because that theory was that language changes at a constant rate. But that theory was thrown out later on by linguists. Because you see some modern languages that have not changed at all. Like in the Baltic area, you find some of the modern languages, like Lithuanian, that hasn't changed at all in the last 1,000 years, or at least 500 to 1,000 years. So that theory was later proved wrong by specific examples. So that was the linguistic analysis, but I don't want to deal so much with that, with that particular aspect of linguistic analysis. But there is a different Sanskrit from the Sanskrit that's there in the original four Vedas, you know, Rig Veda, Tharva Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, than the Bhagavatam. Mm. The Sanskrit is different, and also the Sanskrit is different. It's a more modern version of Sanskrit in the Itihasas. That means, Itihasa means thus it happened, or history, like the Ramayana and Mahabharata. So the reason for that, there's actually a logical reason for that. The reason for that is that the original four Vedas, I'm saying original, although all the Vedas are actually eternal, but what the scientists consider, or the anthropologists consider, the original four Vedas were supposed to be chanted exactly as they were written. In other words, the way that the original four Vedas were passed down is that a disciple had to learn exactly the meter, the pronunciation, each word. Their memories were very good, as Prabhupada describes. They were Shruti Dharas. They could remember, they could hear something once and remember it. Whereas nowadays, we need books. I mean, books are just a crutch. Did you know that? Because we're so fallen, we need books. If we weren't fallen, we wouldn't need books. We would just hear once and we would repeat. But even, you see, when I did the Sanskrit verse this morning, nobody could repeat it. Even just four simple lines, you're not going to repeat it. You know, if I ask you right now, give me even one line, I don't really think anybody in this room will be able to give me one line of the verse we were doing this morning. Isn't it? Even, or even if I asked people what I said 5 minutes ago, you know, maybe one person will remember. Or if I ask you, how were the deities dressed for Mangalarti? I mean, those were Mangalarti. Does anyone remember? No. I mean, the Pujari will remember. I know that person dressed. Or you don't look at the deities now. What color are they dressed in? And who'll even remember that, right? So, Mandasa Mandamati or Mandavati Pakita. So, getting back to the point, the four Vedas were meant to be chanted precisely as they were written. So therefore, the Sanskrit was always exactly the same. Whereas the Itihasa, Purananam, the histories and the Puranas, were not passed down in the same way. They were, you know, like you tell the story of the Mahabharata or the story of the Ramayana. You tell the story, each word doesn't have to be recited precisely the way the other word, the way it was recited 10,000 years ago. So therefore the language will change. Like if I tell the story from the Mahabharata, I'm going to use modern English. Or even, let's say if you read Ganguly's translation of the Mahabharata, Ganguly is probably the most authorized translation of the Mahabharata we have. Has anyone heard of that translation brochure? Pages have probably heard of it. But then his English is very hard even for me to understand because it's English from 100 years ago. So your language does change. So in other words, that's why you have a more modern form of Sanskrit in the Bhagavatam and the Itihasas and the other Puranas too. Because it's the same information, the same details, but presented in modern language. It doesn't mean the book is modern. So the whole linguistic analysis, the point I'm making is that whole aspect of the linguistic analysis is it's a faulty analysis to say because the language is different, therefore the story is modern. You understand? Mm-hmm. If you say that this is Sanskrit and it was 500 years ago, therefore the Ramayana story is 500 years old, that's a faulty conclusion. Because as many stories, I mean, I'll tell stories from my childhood. Like if you ask me about what, Little Red Riding Hood or something? Any of you heard of Little Red Riding Hood? To grandmother's house she went, you know, and there was, a wolf there, and she said, oh, what big mouth you have and big teeth you have. So I'll tell the story in modern times. So that doesn't mean the story is a modern story. It's probably several hundred years old. I mean, I don't know. I've never studied Little Red Riding Hood. Thank God. You know, this is not one of the things that attracts me. But, so in other words, just because I'm reciting the story in modern language doesn't mean the story is a new story. But the Indologists or the anthropologists, they come to that conclusion, which is a ridiculous conclusion.
So the Sanskrit's the same Sanskrit language, but it's just spoken differently.
No, there's a modern, there's different words, it's different conjugated a little bit differently. I mean, Sanskrit. And also another thing is that, you know, it wasn't written down previous to, let's say 2,100 years ago, there wasn't a written language because people remembered. Mm-hmm. You know, the people ask, you know, so how could this is another point. They say that how could there be civilization because there was no writing? Well, people were intelligent. Another point the anthropologists make is they say there is no civilization because we don't discover big cities. Of course, they have recently, but they equate civilization with cities. Mm-hmm. You understand what I mean?
Yeah.
With cities and big buildings, and if you don't see cities and buildings, it's not civilization. Hey, you know, what about a rural civilization? So there's many assumptions they make that help them come up with faulty conclusions in their analysis of the whole thing. So anyway, so say yes, there'll be a more modern form of Sanskrit in the Bhagavatam and in the Itihasas, you know, the Ramayana and Mahabharata historical documents. So that doesn't mean they're not old documents. It just means that the records do. You understand? And it was passed down by people who were more intelligent. It passed down Ivam Parambra, Prabhupada, Mamrajashai, Obihu. Like a mango, like Prabhupada says, passed down hand to hand very, very carefully from one person to another. So the same way the knowledge was passed down through this disciplined succession. And we have an unbroken disciplined succession, so we know the knowledge was passed down purely. Whereas, in some places, or sometimes, disciplined successions, as I mentioned before, get broken. Even the original disciplined succession of the Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Krishna to Vivaswan, Vivaswan to Manu, Manu to Ishvaku, that was broken. So, it is important for us to understand and to look at a disciplic succession to make sure it is unbroken, because anything you receive through a broken disciplic succession does not have value. Sampradaya Vihinayi Mantras. Te Nishpala Madaha. That's an important verse. That something not received through Sampradaya is not valuable. It's not the mantra received. It's not valuable. Not help you advance spiritually.
And where is that from?
I forget. Do you remember where that verse is from? Sampradaya Vinaya. And Prabhupada quotes it many times. I mean, I can look it up in the database later on. Mm-hmm. But Sampradaya Vinaya Mantras Te Nishpala Madaha. And anyone remember where that's from? But that's a verse. I'm sure you've heard it before. Because that's a verse Prabhupada would quote. I mean, it's at least 100 times Prabhupada is quoted in these books. So we receive things through the disciplic succession. And we understand the actual historicity, that is, the history of the Vedic literatures. And this knowledge is timeless. There was human civilization on the earth millions of years ago. And, of course, as our godbrother Dhritakarma has pointed out very nicely in his books, the anthropologists even discovered evidence of human civilization millions of years ago, but because of their knowledge filter, you understand knowledge filter? I don't know what that means. Knowledge filter means that anything that disagrees with your theory, you throw out that evidence. Like, you're so attached to your theory. I mean, that's how you make your living. And you get all your prestige, so if someone comes up with a different theory, then you lose your prestige, or money, or position, or who knows how these people feel. So, any evidence is called anomalous evidence. That's the technical word. Evidence that doesn't fit in. Mm-hmm. So any evidence that doesn't fit in with the present theory, they'll say, well, it's just, you know, it's a quirk, or in the ancient times they had a front end loader and they buried it deeper. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one thing. They don't say front end loader, I'm being joking about that. They say this is intrusive burial. In other words, they'll find bones at a level that indicates those human bones, fully formed, was present 5 million years ago, you know, 2 million years ago, whatever the age is. And they'll say that must be due to an intrusive burial. That means they dug down to bury the guy, they dug down in the earth 100 feet. Now, I don't think that people several hundred years ago really did dig down in the earth 100 feet unless they had mantras, you know, or whatever. And why would they do that anyway? They didn't have bulldozers then, did they? As far as I know. Well, they have mantras. Actually, you know, there's many mysteries in the world, like how were the pyramids put together? They can't figure that out. Because to lift those stones in place, they would have to, of course they said that they had an incline. You know, an incline? Incline plane. They said to put the stones in place, they would have to have an inclined plane that was actually 1 mile long. And it would have to weigh many times more than the pyramid itself. And how would they construct the inclined plane? You know, there's all these mysteries that they don't understand. Of course, we understand that there was Vedic science present even in the beginning of Kali Yuga. They utilized that thing. Because there's actually information, like in the hieroglyphics, you know, Egypt, Egyptian language, that people would recite a certain prayer, which we call the mantra, and the stone would go up into place automatically. Hmm. It's interesting, isn't it? But the scientists say, this is just a mystery, you know, it's just a false, you know, mythology, whatever they call it. Hmm. But here are the stones. How do the stones get in place? And then when the scientists discover there's actually a pyramid in Bosnia. Anyone here been to Bosnia? No, who's been to Bosnia? There's a pyramid that's several times big, three pyramids that are several times bigger than the pyramids in Egypt.
Really?
Yeah. I've been there. I mean, I've actually explored the pyramids there. Yeah. And there are pyramids there. They're actually man-made, because you can see, or intelligent person-made. And you can see, you can actually see the tiles, like you have tiles here, you know, that are laid there. But the scientists say that they're just like natural phenomena. But they're perfectly shaped pyramids, there's tunnels inside them, there's tiles on the floor of them. And all three of them are shaped in a perfect triangle to each other. There's a certain direction that they face that indicates some astrological, astronomical phenomenon. And the scientists say just by chance. But they're bigger than the Egyptian pyramids. And these pyramids were discovered by this, there were satellites, you know, American satellites were overhead when they were during the war in Bosnia. Remember the, I don't know if any remember the wars that they were having.
Just recently, huh?
That was recently. Yeah, the satellite, because they were doing surveillance because of the war, and they saw these three pyramids. And, you know, the archaeologists refused to admit their existence of them. Except for the ones in Bosnia. They said, no, I've been on them. They are man-made. There's no doubt about it. I climbed them.
Well, how come it just came to their notice? Where are they?
Because they're covered with grass.
Oh.
And just like, unless you were flying overhead, you wouldn't see them. You know, because they're actually good. There's not like the Egyptian ones. Because it's a different climate. Mm-hmm. Like, if you make a stone pyramid in Bosnia, where it rains a lot. Anyone's been to Bosnia? No. Where it rains a lot in Bosnia. And Bosnia has so much natural greenery. There are beautiful mountains there, which you can't climb on anymore because there are landmines all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, there's signs all over. Don't climb on this mountain, because the Serbs put landmines all over the country. And people to this day are still like losing their limbs or dying because of these landmines. So they were covered by grass, because grass grows when you have a climate like that. In Egypt, there's no rain, basically. You're in the desert. So there's not too much grass in the Sinai Desert, is there? As far as I know. I haven't been there, but, you know. Except when the Jewish people take over, they irrigate everything. And make everything nice and green. Is that the land of honey or something like that? What is that called?
Milk and honey.
Milk and honey. He's the expert. I don't know about these things. Land of milk and honey. So, and then the Egyptians don't know how to do that, and everything's just a desert. So anyway, so in the desert, you don't have grass growing. So obviously, they wouldn't be covered by grass. So in Bosnia, they were covered by grass. And so, you know, it took a satellite the satellite, of course, they were looking for Serbian soldiers and everything. So they discovered these, and but still the scientists deny that they're actually man-made, because it destroys all their theories about civilization beginning in the Nile Delta. Because they're older than the ones in Egypt. So that's what I'm talking about, the knowledge filter. That anything that goes against their present theory, they just throw out. They said, oh, it couldn't be. You're making a mistake. False dating, or something like that. So their theories are that, you know, civilization began in the Nile Delta, and as far as India, they think it's more recent. But we know this knowledge and civilization has been existing for millions of years. Millions of years it's existed. I mean, even before millions of years. Of course, at the time of the cosmic dissolution, everything comes to an end, and then it's created again. Boudoir. Verliete. That's what Krishna says. Again and again, this manifestation is created and destroyed. Boudoir, again and again. So therefore, what this verse states is the absolute truth. Even our ancient predecessors meditated on the same confidential knowledge. This knowledge is eternal that we're given. It's not some historical phenomena, epiphenomena. That's another fancy word. Epiphenomena of modern civilization or, you know, historic or prehistoric civilization. It's eternal knowledge that stands from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so, of course, as I mentioned, it's not accepted by many modern scientists and biologists or whatever. And basically, their motivation nowadays is actually just to show that everything comes from matter. Like Prabhupada would state, life comes from matter. I mean, matter comes from life. Consciousness comes from life, from the soul. So they're trying to show that consciousness itself is an epiphenomena of matter. That means you put matter together in a certain way and you get consciousness. And so it's a whole atheistic agenda behind the scientists and the anthropologists and atheists, whatever, theories. Previously it was a Christian agenda. Or a Western chauvinistic agenda, but now it's a atheistic agenda, and that's one reason why Prabhupada was so adamant in his establishment of the Bhaktivedanta Institute and his desire to preach to the scientists or against what the scientists were saying. Hmm. Prabhupada really stressed that. I always wondered in the past. Now I don't wonder, but I wondered, why is Prabhupada making so much emphasis, or giving so much emphasis to this scientific preaching? Because this scientific preaching actually underlies the whole Western civilization, the civilization of overconsumption. You are your body, consciousness comes from the body, and, eat, drink, like the Epicurean philosophy, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. And once you die, it's finished. So while you're still here, you at least have some enjoyment as much as possible. Or this Charvaka Muni said, beg, borrow, steal, get yourself some ghee.
Yeah, if you don't have to worry about future lives, all the stress on piety for future lives.
Yeah, what's the use? Just do what gives you the maximum enjoyment. It doesn't really matter. It's just, we're just molecules and atoms. That's all you are, Yogi. You think you're a soul? That's Maya. But anyway, that's illusion. Mm-hmm. And you're sacrificing the best years of your life to do something that has no basis in reality. Look, you gave up your youth for Krishna consciousness when you could have been enjoying having so much illicit life. You wasted everything, Yogi.
So that, he's still wasting it.
So
he didn't give up.
Oh, he didn't give up. So, you're still wasting it. You still haven't given up this Krishna consciousness because there's no soul. So you should just consume, get a credit card or a bunch of credit cards and buy it, shop till you drop. Right?
Well, devotees do that anyway.
You go in the malls and you see the people just mesmerized,
Yeah.
So that's the philosophy behind, modern society. If you are your body, then just do what you have to do and enjoy it. And if you're not enjoying it as much as you'd like to, then join the group that's sitting in on Wall Street and complain that some people are enjoying more than you.
Don't they try to certain humanists, don't they try to establish a certain ethical atheism?
Yeah, there's ethical atheism. Yeah, because you'll be happier. Yeah, you'll be happier if you're ethical. It'll make you happier. It's still based upon the same principle that you will be happier if you're ethical, because we are hardwired. This is a whole anthropological evolutionary explanation about that. That we are hardwired, genetically wired to be ethical. Through evolution, ethics evolve through evolution. That's their theory. So that's ethical humanism. No. based upon Darwinian theory. Mm-hmm. All this stuff is based upon Darwin's theory, or variations of Darwin's theory. Mm-hmm. You know, punctuated evolution, or there's many variations upon Darwin's theory, because they've discovered some flaws in it. But it's all based upon things are getting better. And you'll see the presentation of the companies. Like when I was young, I went to this World's Fair in New York. Did you go there too? That old World's Fair where they had a hemisphere and everything like that? I mean, you had the world.
Like a spaceship on the top.
Yeah, spaceship and everything like that. And was it something like 1964 or so, or 54, I forget exactly. It's been so many years. So I went there and went to the GM Pavilion. And you go down this ride, and you see the future of the world, you see all the cars, and things that, and of course, things we have now that they didn't even dream about, like the cell phones. They had video phones there. I remember they had one video phone where you could talk to someone in Anaheim, California. Do you remember that? Like Disneyland. That's Anaheim. It's Disneyland. So you can see someone in the same place. So we were thinking, it's so wonderful, and the future is so bright, there was a GE Pavilion, there was a General Motors Pavilion. Did you want any of those rides? I loved it. I went and did all those things. And it's a bright new world. You know, I remember the songs they were singing. The future's bright. And they're showing how they're going to have like atomic energy that was going to provide all the energy. And people are going to live longer and everyone's going to be happier. So there's this promise, as Baba said, trust in the future, however pleasant. But so
20-hour work week.
Yeah, 20-hour work week. We were going to have robots or something. Yeah, like that.
Only 4 days, and you work 5 hours each day.
And your work was just sitting down on your butt anyway, which is what people are doing now. And then you'd have these, you just like commute through virtual something, whatever it is, you know, through the internet. Because they didn't have the internet at that
time.
No, there was no internet at that time. It was just telephone lines. And so, you know, you actually experience, like, in a mundane way, things are getting better. Like, when I was young, if you wanted to make a telephone call to someone, you had to actually wind up the telephone. Does anyone remember that?
And you had an operator.
Operator, can I help you? And if you wanted to call, let's say, the West Coast, oh my God, because I could go through 20 different operators plugging things in. And if you were in India, if you wanted to call the United States, forget it. I mean, you have to wait several days. If you got a lightning call, it wasn't called lightning call then?
10 times the normal cost lightning call.
Lightning, and then it was only like a 1 day wait or something like that.
No, it was 15 minutes, half an hour.
15 minutes, half an hour, pretty good.
The operator liked it.
If the operator didn't like you, how long was it?
It cost about $45-$50 for the first 3 minutes.
And that was back in the 60s?
Yeah.
No, that was up into, oh no.
The 70s.
80s.
70s and 80s.
No, 80s.
Yeah.
Remember to the
80s. And I remember also in my airport, you know, they had to contact me. Oh yeah, actually even in the 80s. I remember when this devotee, Chattopadhyay, was killed in... They contacted us in Mayapur by telegraph. Remember the telegraph?
That was 1993.
Yeah, 93. The Mayapur post office had a, you know, one of these old clicker telegraphs. And it was handwritten out. You know, somehow I was able to call here when I found out. But in other words, technology gives us the misimpression that things are getting better, and then you walk, and then it develops a greed for the newer technology. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, now we have our iPads and iPhones and IV in mind. Yeah,
the basic traditional outlook in the world, which has always been the frustration of persons who think of themselves as modern. Is that they're basically uninterested to improve their status quo. Mm. And the opposite is the happy conclusion of modern life is that no matter what your situation is, it's not sufficient.
Yeah, you need more and more.
The motto for a college education, if you do not get an education, you have no future, and you are basically no one.
Yeah.
You have to make something of yourself.
Yeah, that's what,
become someone.
That's what my mother would always tell me, make something of yourself.
Yes.
And she still tells me I can get my medical degree.
That's the personal issue, and then there's the material issue and the relational issue.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. And there's never a point that you exist where it creates neurosis. There's no point in which you cannot exist. Therefore, there's no satiation.
Yeah, there's no satiation. So people are neurotic.
It's built in. They become hardwired themselves that they can't be happy.
Yeah, that's true. And then, of course, the modern diseases are anxiety and depression as a result of that. And that it's interesting, like from an analysis, a psychological analysis, those are the modern expressions of the ancient fight or flight syndromes. You know, like the animals, when they were confronted with a particular situation that was unpleasant, they would either fight or they'd run away. So instead, we get an anxiety, which because we can't really start fighting with each other. Of course, sometimes they do. Like at the recent Black Friday, the people wanted so many material goods at the Walmart that some of the people were pepper spraying each other.
No way.
Yeah.
Where was that?
In Walmart.
Which Walmart?
I don't know.
5,000.
Yeah, one of the Walmarts. So there were riots in some Walmarts. And then there was one lady who wanted some electronic goods before, and she didn't want someone else to get it before her, so she pepper sprayed them. You know, pepper sprayed in the face just to get it. So there's this intense anxiety or fighting or flighting, and sometimes expressed as anxiety or depression, or it sometimes actually comes out like in modern world because of the neurosis, like you pointed out before. So anyway, so underlying that all is this atheism. You know, that happiness is based upon doing something for the body or at best the mind. At best the mind. So
you could take it from another point of view that such a condition is the situation by which atheism is more conducive to develop atheism.
Develop atheism, yeah.
Because you have an underlying, even from the material point of view, an underlying never-ending unhappiness, an underlying never-ending emptiness. And by that, then the only fulfillment is an atheistic
mentality
and gross materialistic activity and mentality.
So they both work together.
One is it's self increasing.
Yeah, self perpetuating.
Yeah.
And increasing. So yeah. So what we have to do, getting to the point, is actually challenge this atheistic philosophy. And cut the very foundation from Western, not the Western, the whole world's underlying understanding. And this way we can establish Christian consciousness. And that's why Prabhupada really wanted to challenge the scientists or the atheists.
From my listening to Srila Prabhupada, he didn't expect too much hope that
they would change.
That they would change. But it was for the benefit of the innocent,
right,
which represents 5,000 to 1. That they would hear that what the scientist is saying is actually weak and illogical.
Mm-hmm.
Prabhupada basically approached it that way, that it was weak and illogical, and it was just hot air.
Yeah.
And then that the persons who were mesmerized by this, and therefore bewildered and confused, that they could hear, and then they could be redeemed, and they could reform, and using intelligence and experience to reject that.
Yeah, that was my understanding.
Most
too.
People think that a dinosaur really existed because you can go to the museum and see it. So whether they existed or not, when they existed, it's very hard to say.
It's all speculative. It's all very speculative. Yeah, that was my understanding too. The Prabhupada wasn't thinking the scientists would change, but the people were victimized by the scientists.
I think it's 99% of Americans really think, especially educated people, that they came from monkeys.
Yeah.
There's a very
Yeah, they're victims. They're actually victims of the scientists. And, you know, one of the modern things is that, you know, amongst these so-called educated people, people think that belief in God is something that we've grown out of. I've run into that all the time. You know, I was at one seminar about something else, about relationships or something like that, and they were asking me about, you know, Krishna consciousness, and I mentioned God, and they said, well, that's primitive. That's something we really outgrew a long time ago. We're more advanced than that. And so that this is, you know, this is the propaganda. So these are the innocent people, the people we have to save from that. And that's why Prabhupada enlisted people like Sariputta and Bhaktisiddhanta Damodar Maharaj. He spent so much time with Bhaktisiddhanta. I was in Los Angeles, and Prabhupada just like every day, he'd say, where is the scientist? Bring him here. I mean, Prabhupada really concentrated on more than even the sannyasis or anyone else in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Maharaj, isn't it also, I don't know, maybe I read it wrong, but didn't Srila Prabhupada say that the dinosaurs came about as a result of the sinful reaction?
I haven't read that. I'd have to read it. So, yeah.
There's a Christian group who are quite open-minded and intelligent, but they're quite Christian. And they created a petition that was circulated to doctors and scientists of all types, just requesting them that, you know, to be scientific, to be a pure scientist.
Mm-hmm.
That since there's no concrete evidence that there's not God, and there is some possibility by logic and understanding that there is a creator, that they should not propagate this false information, be agents of misinformation.
Yeah, agents of misinformation.
And out of 250,000 that they circulated, it was one out of 5,000 agreed to sign a petition that would state that they would be pure scientists.
Only out of one.
Because scientists, we say the word pure science, which means if there's no evidence to the contrary, you remain neutral.
Yeah.
And if you have evidence, it's statistically probable, but it's not a certainty. And so there's no certainty. In fact, there is. I published a paper which showed the certainty of the existence of Paramatma and the soul. I don't know what happened to the reaction in the community.
Of course, the scientists, and the modern atheist scientists, are very illogical in their presentation.
Completely illogical.
Because it's impossible to think in a great certainty, yet they deny it because it goes against their theory. Yes, Mari, do I need you?
Well, Maharaj, I was just wondering if, you know, this reveals my naivete, my simplicity. I never leave the fire, I just make garlands and
Hare
Krishna. But is it, so maybe this sounds silly, but all this emphasis on atheism and sense gratification, is it some kind of conspiracy? Because when years ago, when Nelson Rockefeller died, the devotees were saying that he was actually a Rakshasa. He died with a prostitute, and that they cremated his body right away because, you know, he couldn't maintain that form. And that
your question is, there a conspiracy? My and this is my opinion, and devotees get into all these conspiracy theories, but in Kali Yuga, those people who are atheists or, you know, not interested in worship of God, I don't think they can coordinate amongst themselves well enough to have a conspiracy. I mean, even we devotees can't keep a secret. You know, they talk about all these things, the Mason conspiracy or the Jewish conspiracy or this and that. You know, like people are meeting in some room to discuss things. I mean, it's certainly the business interests, they're manipulating the economy and things like that. But this dark idea of conspiracy, even the people who are, you know, meat eaters, sinful people, are not coordinated enough. They're fighting amongst themselves. I mean, we fight amongst ourselves, don't we? I mean, we have plenty of internecine fights, I mean, it's like within the family. So
there definitely are individuals,
they're individuals
within their own protocol, are seeing the chinks of person is Noam Chomsky, but I wouldn't want to say the whole thing. And he was the one who came to the, supposedly gave a statement in his transformational grammar that what was missing in all the other scientists, he just, he didn't give any evidence, so it's just his desire to propel atheism.
Yeah.
And he said that he claims to have, just because he made a statement, proven that consciousness can arise from matter, and everybody quotes Chomsky.
Yeah, but there's been no evidence that consciousness.
But he was self-motivated. He did it intentionally.
Yeah.
He knows it's wrong.
Oh, he knows it's wrong.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they have ulterior motives.
He's an avowed demon, so.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Avowed demon.
Yeah, he's
he made a promise to God to be a demon. there are individuals, yes, who are doing certain things, obviously, but I don't think that there are people sitting in some room, you know, planning out all these things, because they can't coordinate amongst themselves.
There is a person, her name is Maya.
Oh yeah, Maya. You know, Maya, she's doing a good job.
She has a tremendous conspiracy going on.
Yeah, that's a conspiracy. But as far as, you know, Bill Clinton or I'm not going to mention anyone else. Or George Bush, you know, just because they all have a Mason's ring on their finger, you know. And the dollar bill has this, you know, like this pyramid there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we better just spend time on chanting Hare Krishna rather than getting into it. Because I know devotees, some of the devotees here in the past have really gotten into conspiracies. It doesn't help our devotional service. You know, let's work on working with each other. Let's have a Krishna conspiracy.
Maharaj, you mentioned where the only people that won't be attracted to Krishna Katha are the killers of the soul.
Or the killers of animals.
Meat eaters. So how is it?
That's from the verse in the Bhagavatam, the 10th canto.
Right. But I mean, Lord Chaitanya also said the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But how is it that we became... because I was just raised.
I have a question. Isn't that verse more referring to it? Prabhupada mentioned this indirectly in his introduction to the Krishna book. Isn't that more referring to the intimate pastimes of Krishna? That they cannot have the taste for hearing that.
Yeah, but it's also in reference to Krishna Katha in general. That's my understanding, is it's reference to Krishna Katha, because that's also Krishna Katha, like whether it's the pastime of Lord Varaha or Hiranyakashipu fighting. I mean, the pastimes of Krishna in any of his various incarnations. And attraction means it attracts the mind, not just they're interested in studying it. There's a difference between like a academic attraction, you know, just like interest, and an attraction, you know, something that really draws the heart and the mind facilitates you in changing your life and devoting your life to something. And I've seen, like it's Prabhupada said in another place, for a meat eater to understand the philosophy is impossible. Understand deeply. We're not talking about theoretically. Yeah, anybody can say, you Hare Krishnas believe you're not the body and that there's a God. But to actually understand it, you know, vijnana, it's required to give up eating meat. I mean, there's many words. Lord Chaitanya said that.
When you qualify with the word begin, understand.
Yeah, understand. I mean, you can certainly understand things. I mean, I can understand atheism, but I don't have too much vijnana about it. I mean, I can understand the detail. I can understand, you know, so many things. Science, atomic science, which is my field before I joined the society. You know, I was working with atomic materials. But I don't know if I realize what's happening. And so, nor am I attracted. Nor do I want to make a lifestyle change. You know, so if we want, in other words, to be a devotee, you've got to be a vegetarian. That's really the essence of the whole thing. To really be a devotee, you've got to be a vegetarian.
What do you think about...
To be ethical, you have to be a vegetarian. It's a necessary requirement. It's not sufficient, you know, because even like Prabhupada said, the monkeys are vegetarians, but it's necessary. to even be ethical. I mean, even you have Christians who realize that. Like St. Francis.
What is the quality of eating meat kills for the poor?
Mercy. It's mercy, but it's just like, it's common sense. I mean, I became a vegetarian years before I joined the Hare Krishna movement, because as soon as I realized that where meat came from.
Mercy.
You know, the meat came from an animal. Animals have feelings. I mean, if someone doesn't give it up understanding that, I mean, basically they need to work on their ethical principles, what to speak of, religious principles. You know, in America it's so strange. If you were to kill your dog and eat your dog, you'd go to prison. Right? You know, if you invite the police, you know, having a dog barbecue today, they'll take you to prison. But if you invite the police for a pig or a cow barbecue, you know, the whole police department will show up and they'll be very happy with you. You know, come on. And then another argument I use, and if people say, I don't believe animals have a soul. I said, so why do you keep a dog? Why don't you just keep a vacuum cleaner? At least vacuum cleaners are clean things. Dogs pass stool all over the place. And if it has no soul, what's the difference between one machine and another machine? But you love your dog, don't you? And your dog loves you. You know, most people have dogs in America. And they say, yes. So where does love come from? Consciousness? Or does it come from the machine? Does your computer love you? Has your computer ever kissed you? Of course, in the future, they probably will. What do they say? The blue screen of death.
People who have Apples love their computer.
Oh, yeah, the Apple computer. I mean,
you have to love your Apple.
Ugh. Love your Apple. All right, so I think we have to end now, because I love prasadam. It's time to take prasadam. All glories to His divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.